Chapter 15, 1757. Fort William Henry. I am going on the 9th to sing the war song at the Lake of the Mountains, and in the next day at Sault Street. Lewis, a long, tiresome ceremony. In the 12th I am off, and I count on having news to tell you by the end of this month or the beginning of next. Thus Montcalm wrote to his wife from Montreal early in July. All doubts had been solved. Prisoners taken on the Hudson and dispatches from Versailles had made it certain that Loudon was bound to Louisbourg, carrying with him the best of the troops that had guarded the New York frontier. The time was come, not only to strike the English in Lake George, but perhaps to seize Fort Edward and carry terror to Albany itself. Only one difficulty remained, the want of provisions. Agents were sent to collect corn and bacon among the inhabitants, the cures and militia captains were ordered to aid in the work, and enough was presently found to feed 12,000 men for a month. The emissaries of the governor had been busy all winter among the tribes of the west and north, and more than 1,000 savages, lured by prospect of gifts, scalps, and plunder, were now encamped at Montreal. Many of them had never visited a French settlement before. All were eager to see Montcalm, whose exploit in taking Oswego had inflamed their imagination, and one day, in a visit of ceremony, an order from Michilimackinac addressed the general thus: "We wanted to see this famous man who tramples the English under his feet. We thought we should find him so tall that his head would be lost in the clouds. But you are a little man, my father. It is when we look into your eyes that we see the greatness of the pine tree and the fire of the eagle." Quote, "It remained to muster the Mission Indians settled in or near the limits of the colony, and it was to this end that Montcalm went to sing the war song with the converts of the Two Mountains. Rigaud, Bougainville, young Longueuil, and others were of the party, and when they landed, the Indians came down to the shore, their priests at their head, and greeted the general with a volley of musketry, then received him after dark in their grand council lodge, where the circle of wild and savage visages, half seen in the dim light of a few candles, suggested to Bougainville a midnight conclave of wizards. He acted vicariously the chief part in the ceremony. I sang the war song in the name of M. de Montcalm, and was much applauded. It was nothing but these words: 'Let us trample the English under our feet,' chanted over and over again, in cadence with the movements of the savages. Then came the war feast, against which occasion Montcalm had caused 3 oxen to be roasted. In the next day the party went to Conodoga, or Sault Street, Lewis, where the ceremony was repeated, and Bougainville, who again sang the war song in the name of his commander, was requited by adoption into the clan of the Turtle. 3 more oxen were solemnly devoured, and with one voice the warriors took up the hatchet. Meanwhile troops, Canadians and Indians, were moving by detachments up Lake Champlain. Fleets of bateaux and canoes followed each other day by day along the capricious lake, in calm or storm, sunshine or rain, till, towards the end of July, the whole force was gathered at Ticonderoga, the base of the intended movement. Bourlamaque had been there since May with the battalions of Berney and Royal Roussillon, finishing the fort, sending out war parties, and trying to discover the force and designs of the English at Fort William Henry. Ticonderoga is a high rocky promontory between Lake Champlain in the north and the mouth of the outlet of Lake George in the south. Near its extremity and close to the fort were still encamped the 2 battalions under Bourlamaque, while bateaux and canoes were passing incessantly up the river of the outlet. There were scarcely 2 miles of navigable water, at the end of which the stream fell foaming over a high ledge of rock that barred the way. Here the French were building a sawmill, and a wide space had been cleared to form an encampment defended in all sides by an abattis, within which stood the tents of the battalions of Lorraine, Losser, Languedoc, and Guienne, all commanded by Levis. Above the cascade the stream circled through the forest in a series of beautiful rapids, and from the camp of Levis a road a mile and a half long had been cut to the navigable water above. At the end of this road there was another fortified camp, formed of colony regulars, Canadians, and Indians, under Rigaud. It was scarcely a mile farther to Lake George, where on the western side there was an outpost, chiefly of Canadians and Indians, while advanced parties were stationed at Bald Mountain, now called Rogers Rock, and elsewhere in the lake, to watch the movements of the English. The various encampments just mentioned were ranged along a valley extending 4 miles from Lake Champlain to Lake George, and bordered by mountains wooded to the top. Here was gathered a martial population of 8,000 men, including the brightest civilization and the darkest barbarism, from the scholar soldier Montcalm and his no less accomplished aide-de-camp from Levis, conspicuous for graces of person from a throng of courtly young officers, who would have seemed out of place in that wilderness had they not done their work so well in it, from these to the foulest man-eating savage of the uttermost northwest. Of Indian allies there were nearly 2,000. One of their tribes, the Iowas, spoke a language which no interpreter understood, and they all bivouacked where they saw fit, for no man could control them. "I see no difference," says Bougainville, "in the dress, ornaments, dances, and songs of the various Western nations. They go naked, excepting a strip of cloth passed through a belt, and paint themselves black, red, blue, and other colors. Their heads are shaved and adorned with bunches of feathers, and they wear rings of brass wire in their ears. They wear beaver skin blankets, and carry lances, bows and arrows, and quivers made of the skins of beasts. For the rest they are straight, well made, and generally very tall. Their religion is brute paganism."
"I will say it once for all, one must be the slave of these savages, listen to them day and night, in council and in private, whenever the fancy takes them, or, whenever a dream, a fit of the vapors, or their perpetual craving for brandy, gets possession of them, besides which they are always wanting something for their equipment, arms, or toilet, and the general of the army must give written orders for the smallest trifle, an eternal, wearisome detail, of which one has no idea in Europe. Quote, it was not easy to keep them fed. Rations would be served to them for a week, they would consume them in 3 days, and come for more. In one occasion they took the matter into their own hands, and butchered and devoured 18 head of cattle intended for the troops, nor did any officer dare oppose this street Bartholomew of the Oxen, as Bougainville calls it. Their paradise is to be drunk, says the young officer. Their paradise was rather a hell, for sometimes, when mad with brandy, they grappled and tore each other with their teeth like wolves. They were continually making medicine, that is, consulting the Manitou, to whom they hung up offerings, sometimes a dead dog, and sometimes the belt cloth which formed their only garment. The Mission Indians were better allies than these heathen of the West, and their priests, who followed them to the war, had great influence over them. They were armed with guns, which they well knew how to use. Their dress, though savage, was generally decent, and they were not cannibals, though in other respects they retained all their traditional ferocity and most of their traditional habits. They held frequent war feasts, one of which is described by Rabaud, Jesuit missionary of the Abenakis of St. Francis, whose flock formed a part of the company present. Imagine, says the father, a great assembly of savages adorned with every ornament most suited to disfigure them in European eyes, painted with vermilion, white, green, yellow, and black made of soot and the scrapings of pots. A single savage face combines all these different colors, methodically laid in with the help of a little tallow, which serves for pomatum. The head is shaved, except at the top, where there is a small tuft, to which are fastened feathers, a few beads of wampum, or some such trinket. Every part of the head has its ornament. Pendants hang from the nose and also from the ears, which are split in infancy and drawn down by weights till they flap at last against the shoulders. The rest of the equipment answers to this fantastic decoration, a shirt bedaubed with vermilion, wampum colors, silver bracelets, a large knife hanging on the breast, fur-skin moccasins, and a belt of various colors always absurdly combined. The sachems and war chiefs are distinguished from the rest, the latter by a gorget, and the former by a medal, with the king's portrait in one side, and in the other Mars and Bellona joining hands, with the device, virtues and honor. Quote, thus attired, the company sat in two lines facing each other, with kettles in the middle filled with meat chops for distribution. To a dignified silence succeeded songs, sung by several chiefs in succession, and compared by the narrator to the howling of wolves. Then followed a speech from the chief orator, highly commended by Rabaud, who could not help admiring this effort of savage eloquence. After the harangue, he continues, they proceeded to nominate the chiefs who were to take command. As soon as one was named he rose and took the head of some animal that had been butchered for the feast. He raised it aloft, so that all the company could see it, and cried, behold the head of the enemy. Applause and cries of joy rose from all parts of the assembly. The chief, with the head in his hand, passed down between the lines, singing his war song, bragging of his exploits, taunting and defying the enemy, and glorifying himself beyond all measure. To hear his self-laudation in these moments of martial transport one would think him a conquering hero ready to sweep everything before him. As he passed in front of the other savages, they would respond by dull broken cries jerked up from the depths of their stomachs, and accompanied by movements of their bodies so odd that one must be well used to them to keep countenance. In the course of his song the chief would utter from time to time some grotesque witticism, then he would stop, as if pleased with himself, or rather to listen to the thousand confused cries of applause that greeted his ears. He kept up his martial promenade as long as he liked the sport, and when he had had enough, ended by flinging down the head of the animal with an air of contempt, to show that his warlike appetite craved meat of another sort. Others followed with similar songs and pantomime, and the festival was closed at last by ladling out the meat from the kettles, and devouring it. Rabaud was one day near the fort, when he saw the shore lined with a thousand Indians, watching four or five English prisoners, who, with the war party that had captured them, were approaching in a boat from the farther side of the water. Suddenly the whole savage crew broke away together and ran into the neighboring woods, whence they soon emerged, yelling diabolically, each armed with a club. The wretched prisoners were to be forced to run the gauntlet which would probably have killed them. They were saved by the chief who commanded the war party, and who, in the persuasion of a French officer, claimed them, as his own and forbade the game, upon which, according to rule in such cases, the rest abandoned it.
In this same day the missionary met troops of Indians conducting several bands of English prisoners along the road that led through the forest from the camp of Levi's. Each of the captives was held by a cord made fast about the neck, and the sweat was starting from their brows in the extremity of their horror and distress. Rudolph's tent was at this time in the camp of the Ottawas. He presently saw a large number of them squatted about a fire, before which meat was roasting on sticks stuck in the ground, and, approaching, he saw that it was the flesh of an Englishman, other parts of which were boiling in a kettle, while nearby sat 8 or 10 of the prisoners, forced to see their comrade devoured. The horror-stricken priest began to remonstrate, in which the young savage fiercely replied in broken French, "You have French taste, I have Indian. This is good meat for me," and the feasters pressed him to share it. Bougainville says that this abomination could not be prevented, which only means that, if force had been used to stop it, the Ottawas would have gone home in a rage. They were therefore left to finish their meal undisturbed. Having eaten one of their prisoners, they began to treat the rest with the utmost kindness, bringing them white bread, and attending to all their wants a seeming change of heart due to the fact that they were a valuable commodity, for which the owners hoped to get a good price at Montreal. Montcalm wished to send them thither at once, to which after long debate the Indians consented, demanding, however, a receipt in full, and bargaining that the captives should be supplied with shoes and blankets. These unfortunates belonged to a detachment of 300 provincials, chiefly New Jersey men, sent from Fort William Henry under command of Colonel Parker to reconnoitre the French outposts. Montcalm's scouts discovered them, in which a band of Indians, considerably more numerous, went to meet them under a French partisan named Corbier, and ambushed themselves not far from Sabbath Day Point. Parker had rashly divided his force, and at daybreak of the 26th of July 3 of his bolts fell into the snare, and were captured without a shot. 3 others followed, in ignorance of what had happened, and shared the fate of the first. When the rest drew near, they were greeted by a deadly volley from the thickets, and a swarm of canoes darted out upon them. The men were seized with such a panic that some of them jumped into the water to escape, while the Indians leaped after them and speared them with their lances like fish. Terrified, says Bougainville, by the sight of these monsters, their agility, their firing, and their yells, they surrendered almost without resistance. About 100, however, made their escape. The rest were killed or captured, and 3 of the bodies were eaten on the spot. The journalist adds that the victory so elated the Indians that they became insupportable, but here in the forests of America we can no more do without them than without cavalry in the plain. Another success at about the same time did not tend to improve their manners. 150 of them, along with a few Canadians under Marin, made a dash at Fort Edward, killed or drove in the pickets, and returned with 32 scalps and a prisoner. It was found, however, that the scalps were far from representing an equal number of heads, the Indians having learned the art of making 2 or 3 out of 1 by judicious division. Preparations were urged in with the utmost energy. Provisions, camp equipage, ammunition, cannon, and bateaux were dragged by gangs of men up the road from the camp of Levi's to the head of the rapids. The work went on through heat and rain, by day and night, till, at the end of July, all was done. Now, in the eve of departure, Montcalm, anxious for harmony among his red allies, called them to a grand council near the camp of Rigaud. 41 tribes and sub-tribes, Christian and heathen, from the east and from the west, were represented in it. Here were the mission savages, Iroquois of Gonogoga, to mountains, and La Presentation, Hurons of Loretta and Detroit, Nipissings of Lake Nipissing, Abenakis of St. Francis, Bicancour, Missisquoi, and the Penobscot, Algonquins of Three Rivers and Two Mountains, Mi'kmaqs and Malisets from Acadia, in all 800 chiefs and warriors.
With these came the heathen of the West, Ottawas of seven distinct bands, Ojibways from Lake Superior, and Mississaugas from the region of Lakes Erie and Huron, Cotahatamies and Menomonies from Lake Michigan, Sacs, Foxes, and Winnebagoes from Wisconsin, Miamis from the prairies of Illinois, and Iowas from the banks of the Des Moines, 979 chiefs and warriors, men of the forests and men of the plains, hunters of the moose and hunters of the buffalo, bearers of steel hatchets and stone war clubs, of French guns and of flint-headed arrows. All sat in silence, decked with ceremonial paint, scalp locks, eagle plumes, or horns of buffalo, and the dark and wild assemblage was edged with white uniforms of officers from France, who came in numbers to the spectacle. Other officers were also here, all belonging to the colony. They had been appointed to the command of the Indian allies, over whom, however, they had little or no real authority.
First among them was the bold and hardy St. Luc de La Corne, who was called General of the Indians, and under him were others, each assigned to some tribe or group of tribes, the intrepid Marin, Charles Langlade, who had left his squaw wife at Michilimackinac to join the war, Niverville, Langdus, La Plante, Hurdle, Longueuil, Herbin, Lorimier, Sabrevoice, and Fleurimont, men familiar from childhood with forests and savages. Each tribe had its interpreter, often as lawless as those with whom he had spent his life, and for the converted tribes there were three missionaries, Piquet for the Iroquois, Mathivet for the Nipissings, who were half-heathen, and Rudaud for the Abenakis. There was some complaint among the Indians, because they were crowded upon by the officers who came as spectators. This difficulty being removed, the council opened, Montcalm having already explained his plans to the chiefs and told them the part he expected them to play. Pinahowl, chief of the Ottawas, and senior of all the assembly, rose and said, "My father, I, who have counted more moons than any here, thank you for the good words you have spoken. I approve them. Nobody ever spoke better. It is the Manitou of war who inspires you." Quote, Kakensik, chief of the Nipissings, rose in behalf of the Christian Indians, and addressed the heathen of the West. "Brothers, we thank you for coming to help us defend our lands against the English. Our cause is good. The Master of Life is on our side. Can you doubt it, brothers, after the great blow you have just struck? It covers you with glory. The lake, red with the blood of Corlor left square bracket the English right square bracket bears witness forever to your achievement. We to share your glory, and are proud of what you have done." Then, turning to Montcalm, "We are even more glad than you, my father, who have crossed the great water, not for your own sake, but to obey the great king and defend his children. He has bound us all together by the most solemn of ties. Let us take care that nothing shall separate us." Quote, the various interpreters, each in turn, having explained this speech to the assembly, it was received with ejaculations of applause, and when they had ceased, Montcalm spoke as follows, "Children, I am delighted to see you all joined in this good work. So long as you remain one, the English cannot resist you. The great king has sent me to protect and defend you, but above all he has charged me to make you happy and unconquerable, by establishing among you the union which ought to prevail among brothers, children of one father, the great Anangio. Then he held out a prodigious wampum belt of 6,000 beads, take the sacred pledge of his word. The union of the beads of which it is made is the sign of your united strength. By it I bind you all together, so that none of you can separate from the rest till the English are defeated and their fort destroyed. Quote, Pinanhoel took up the belt and said, Behold, brothers, a circle drawn around us by the great Anangio. Let none of us go out from it, for so long as we keep in it, the Master of Life will help all our undertakings. Other chiefs spoke to the same effect, and the council closed in perfect harmony. Its various members bivouacked together at the camp by the lake, and by their carelessness soon set it on fire, whence the place became known as the Burned Camp. Those from the missions confessed their sins all day, while their heathen brothers hung an old coat and a pair of leggings on a pole, as tribute to the Manitou. This greatly embarrassed the three priests, who were about to say Mass, but doubted whether they ought to say it in presence of a sacrifice to the devil. Hereupon they took counsel of Monkham. Better say it so than not at all, replied the military casualist. Brandy being prudently denied them, the allies grew restless, and the greater part paddled up the lake to a spot near the place where Parker had been defeated. Here they encamped to wait the arrival of the army, and amused themselves meantime with killing rattlesnakes, there being a populous den of those reptiles among the neighboring rocks. Monkham sent a circular letter to the regular officers, urging them to dispense for a while with luxuries, and even comforts. We have but few bateaux, and these are so filled with stores that a large division of the army must go by land, and he directed that everything not absolutely necessary should be left behind, and that a canvas shelter to every two officers should serve them for a tent, and a bearskin for a bed. Yet I do not forbid a mattress, he adds. Age and infirmities may make it necessary to some, but I shall not have one myself, and make no doubt that all who can will willingly imitate me. The bateaux lay ready by the shore, but could not carry the whole force, and Levi's received orders to march by the side of the lake with 2,500 men, Canadians, regulars, and Iroquois. He set out at daybreak of the 30th of July, his men carrying nothing but their knapsacks, blankets, and weapons. Guided by the unerring Indians, they climbed the steep gorge at the side of Rogers Rock, gained the valley beyond, and marched southward along the Mohawk Trail which threaded the forest in a course parallel to the lake. The way was of the roughest, many straggled from the line, and two officers completely broke down. The first destination of the party was the mouth of Ganowski Bay, now called Northwest Bay, where they were to wait for Monkham, and kindle three fires, as a signal that they had reached the rendezvous. Monkham left a detachment to hold Ticonderoga, and then, in the 1st of August, at 2 in the afternoon, he embarked at the Burn Camp with all his remaining force. Including those with Levi's, the expedition counted about 7,600 men, of whom more than 1,600 were Indians. At 5 in the afternoon they reached the place where the Indians, having finished their rattlesnake hunt, were smoking their pipes and waiting for the army. The Red Warriors embarked and joined the French flotilla, and now, as evening grew near, was seen one of those wild pageantries of war which Lake George has often witnessed. A restless multitude of birch canoes, filled with painted savages, glided by shores and islands, like troops of swimming waterfowl. 250 bateaux came next, moved by sail and oar, some bearing the Canadian militia, and some the battalions of old France in trim and gay attire. First, La Reine and Languedoc, then the colony regulars, then La Serre and Guienne, then the Canadian Brigade of Cordemange, then the cannon and mortars, each on a platform sustained by two bateaux lashed side by side, and rowed by the militia of Saint-Ars, then the battalions of Berny and Royal Roussillon, then the Canadians of Gasp, with the provision bateaux and the field hospital, and, lastly, a rear guard of regulars closed the line. So, under the flush of sunset, they held their course along the romantic lake, to play their part in the historic drama that lends a stern enchantment to its fascinating scenery. They passed the narrows in mist and darkness, and when, a little before dawn, they rounded the high promontory of Tongue Mountain, they saw, far on the right, three fiery sparks shining through the gloom. These were the signal fires of Levi's, to tell them that he had reached the appointed spot. Levi's had arrived the evening before, after his hard march through the sultry midsummer forest. His men had now rested for a night, and at 10 in the morning he marched again. Montcalm followed at noon, and coasted the western shore, till, towards evening, he found Levi's waiting for him by the margin of a small bay not far from the English fort, though hidden from it by a projecting point of land. Canoes and bateaux were drawn up on the beach, and the united forces made their bivouac together. The earthen mounds of Fort William Henry still stand by the brink of Lake George, and seated at the sunset of an August day under the pines that cover them, one gazes in a scene of soft and soothing beauty, where dreamy waters reflect the glories of the mountains and the sky. As it is today, so it was then, all breathed repose and peace. The splash of some leaping trout, or the dipping wing of a passing swallow, alone disturbed the summer calm of that unruffled mirror. About 10 o'clock at night, two boats set out from the fort to reconnoiter. They were passing a point of land in their left, 2 miles or more down the lake, when the men inboard descried through the gloom a strange object against the bank, and they rowed towards it to learn what it might be. It was an awning over the bateaux that carried Rudyard and his brother missionaries. As the rash oarsmen drew near, the bleating of a sheep in one of the French provision boats warned them of danger, and turning, they pulled for their lives towards the eastern shore. Instantly more than 1,000 Indians threw themselves into their canoes and dashed in hot pursuit, making the lake and the mountains ring with the din of their war whoops. The fugitives had nearly reached land, when their pursuers opened fire. They replied, shot one Indian dead, and wounded another, then snatched their oars again, and gained the beach. But the whole savage gloom was upon them. Several were killed, 3 were taken, and the rest escaped in the dark woods. The prisoners were brought before Montcalm, and gave him valuable information of the strength and position of the English. The Indian who was killed was a noted chief of the Nipissings, and his tribesmen howled in grief for their bereavement. They painted his face with vermilion, tied feathers in his hair, hung pendants in his ears and nose, clad him in a resplendent war dress, put silver bracelets in his arms, hung a gorget in his breast with a flame-colored ribbon, and seated him in state on the top of a hillock, with his lance in his hand, his gun in the hollow of his arm, his tomahawk in his belt, and his kettle by his side. Then they all crouched about him in lugubrious silence. A funeral harangue followed, and next a song and solemn dance to the booming of the Indian drum. In the gray of the morning they buried him, as he sat, and placed food in the grave for his journey to the land of souls. As the sun rose above the eastern mountains, the French camp was all astir.
The column of Levi's,
with Indians to lead the way, moved through the forest towards the fort, and Montcalm followed with the main body. Then the artillery bolts rounded the point that had hid them from the sight of the English, saluting them, as they did so, with musketry and cannon, while a host of savages put out upon the lake, ranged their canoes abreast in a line from shore to shore, and advanced slowly, with measured paddle strokes and yells of defiance. The position of the enemy was full in sight before them. At the head of the lake, towards the right, stood the fort, close to the edge of the water. In its left was a marsh, then the rough piece of ground, where Johnson had encamped 2 years before, then a low, flat, rocky hill, crowned with an entrenched camp, and, lastly, in the extreme left, another marsh. Far around the fort and up the slopes of the western mountain the forest had been cut down and burned, and the ground was cumbered with blackened stumps and charred carcasses and limbs of fallen trees, strewn in savage disorder one upon another. This was the work of Winslow in the autumn before. Distant shouts and war cries, the clatter of musketry, white puffs of smoke in the dismal clearing and along the scorched edge of the bordering forest, told that Levi's Indians were skirmishing with parties of the English, who had gone out to save the cattle roaming in the neighborhood, and burn some outbuildings that would have favored the besiegers. Others were taking down the tents that stood in a plateau near the foot of the mountain in the right, and moving them to the entrenchment in the hill. The garrison sallied from the fort to support their comrades, and for a time the firing was hot. Fort William Henry was an irregular bastion square, formed by embankments of gravel surmounted by a rampart of heavy logs, laid in tiers crossed one upon another, the interstices filled with earth. The lake protected it on the north, the marsh in the east, and ditches which avoided the fray on the south and west. 17 cannon, great and small, besides several mortars and swivels, were mounted upon it, and a brave Scotch veteran, Lieutenant Colonel Monroe, of the 35th Regiment, was in command. General Webb lay 14 miles distant at Fort Edward, with 2,600 men, chiefly provincials. In the 25th of July he had made a visit to Fort William Henry, examined the place, given some orders, and returned in the 29th. He then wrote to the governor of New York, telling him that the French were certainly coming, begging him to send up the militia, and saying, "I am determined to march to Fort William Henry with the whole army under my command as soon as I shall hear of the farther approach of the enemy." Instead of doing so he waited 3 days, and then sent up a detachment of 200 regulars under Lieutenant Colonel Young, and 800 Massachusetts men under Colonel Fry. This raised the force at the lake to 2,200. Including sailors and mechanics, and reduced that of Webb to 1,600, besides half as many more distributed at Albany and the intervening forts. If, according to his spirited intention, he should go to the rescue of Monroe, he must leave some of his troops behind him to protect the lower posts from a possible French inroad by way of South Bay. Thus his power of aiding Monroe was slight, so rashly had Loudon, intent on Louisburg, left this frontier open to attack. The defect, however, was as much in Webb himself as in his resources. His conduct in the past year had raised doubts of his personal courage, and this was the moment for answering them. Great as was the disparity of numbers, the emergency would have justified an attempt to save Monroe at any risk. That officer sent him a hasty note, written at 9 o'clock in the morning of the 3rd, telling him that the French were in sight in the lake, and, in the next night, 3 rangers came to Fort Edward, bringing another short note, dated at 6 in the evening, announcing that the firing had begun, and closing with the words, "I believe you will think it proper to send a reinforcement as soon as possible. Now, if ever, was the time to move, before the fort was invested and access cut off." But Webb lay quiet, sending expresses to New England for help which could not possibly arrive in time. In the next night another note came from Monroe to say that the French were upon him in great numbers, well supplied with artillery, but that the garrison were all in good spirits. "I make no doubt," wrote the hard-pressed officer, "that you will soon send us a reinforcement, and again in the same day, we are very certain that a part of the enemy have got between you and us upon the high road, and would therefore be glad, if it meets with your approbation, the whole army was marched." But Webb gave no sign. When the skirmishing around the fort was over, Lockhorn, with a body of Indians, occupied the road that led to Fort Edward, and Levi's encamped hard by to support him, while Montcalm proceeded to examine the ground and settle his plan of attack. He made his way to the rear of the entrenched camp and reconnoitred it, hoping to carry it by assault, but it had a breastwork of stones and logs, and he thought the attempt too hazardous. The ground where he stood was that where Disko had been defeated, and as the fate of his predecessor was not of flattering augury, he resolved to besiege the fort in form. He chose for the site of his operations the ground now covered by the village of Caldwell. A little to the north of it was a ravine, beyond which he formed his main camp, while Levi's occupied a tract of dry ground beside the marsh, whence he could easily move to intercept succors from Fort Edward in the one hand, or repel a sortie from Fort William Henry on the other. A brook ran down the ravine and entered the lake at a small cove protected from the fire of the fort by a point of land, and at this place, still called Artillery Cove, Montcalm prepared to debark his cannon and mortars. Having made his preparations, he sent Von Brunn, one of his aides-de-camp, with a letter to Monroe. "I owe it to humanity," he wrote, "to summon you to surrender. At present I can restrain the savages, and make them observe the terms of a capitulation, as I might not have power to do under other circumstances, and an obstinate defense in your part could only retard the capture of the place a few days, and endanger an unfortunate garrison which cannot be relieved, in consequence of the dispositions I have made. I demand a decisive answer within an hour." Monroe replied that he and his soldiers would defend themselves to the last. While the flags of truce were flying, the Indians swarmed over the fields before the fort, and when they learned the result, an Abenaki chief shouted in broken French, "You won't surrender, eh? Fire away then, and fight your best, for, if I catch you, you shall get no quarter." Monroe emphasized his refusal by a general discharge of his cannon. The trenches were opened in the night of the 4th, a task of extreme difficulty, as the ground was covered by a profusion of half-burned stumps, roots, branches, and fallen trunks. 800 men toiled till daylight with pick, spade, and axe, while the cannon from the fort flashed through the darkness, and grape and round shot whistled and screamed over their heads. Some of the English balls reached the camp beyond the ravine, and disturbed the slumbers of the officers off duty, as they lay wrapped in their blankets and bearskins. Before daybreak the first parallel was made. A battery was nearly finished on the left, and another was begun on the right. The men now worked under cover, safe in their burrows. One gang relieved another, and the work went on all day. The Indians were far from doing what was expected of them. Instead of scouting in the direction of Fort Edward to learn the movements of the enemy and prevent surprise, they loitered about the camp and in the trenches, or amused themselves by firing at the fort from behind stumps and logs. Some, in imitation of the French, dug little trenches for themselves, in which they wormed their way towards the rampart, and now and then picked off an artilleryman, not without loss in their own side. In the afternoon of the 5th, Montcalm invited them to a council, gave them belts of wampum, and mildly remonstrated with them. "Why expose yourselves without necessity? I grieve bitterly over the losses that you have met, for the least among you is precious to me. No doubt it is a good thing to anoint the English, but that is not the main point. You ought to inform me of everything the enemy is doing, and always keep parties on the road between the two forts." And he gently hinted that their place was not in his camp, but in that of Levi's, where missionaries were provided for such of them as were Christians, and food and ammunition for them all. They promised, with excellent docility, to do everything he wished, but added that there was something on their hearts. Being encouraged to relieve themselves of the burden, they complained that they had not been consulted as to the management of the siege, but were expected to obey orders like slaves. "We know more about fighting in the woods than you," said their orator. "Ask our advice, and you will be the better for it." Montcalm assured them that, if they had been neglected, it was only through the hurry and confusion of the time, expressed high appreciation of their talents for bush fighting, promised them ample satisfaction, and ended by telling them that in the morning they should hear the big guns. This greatly pleased them, for they were extremely impatient for the artillery to begin. About sunrise the battery of the left opened with 8 heavy cannon and a mortar, joined, in the next morning, by the battery of the right, with 11 pieces more. The fort replied with spirit. The cannon thundered all day, and from 100 peaks and crags the astonished wilderness roared back the sound. The Indians were delighted. They wanted to point the guns, and to humor them, they were now and then allowed to do so. Others lay behind logs and fallen trees, and yelled their satisfaction when they saw the splinters fly from the wooden rampart. Day after day the weary roar of the distant cannonade fell on the ears of Webb in his camp at Fort Edward. "I have not yet received the least reinforcement," he writes to Loudon. "This is the disagreeable situation we are at present in. The fort, by the heavy firing we hear from the lake, is still in our possession, but I fear it cannot long hold out against so warm a cannonading, if I am not reinforced by a sufficient number of militia to march to their relief." The militia were coming, but it was impossible that many could reach him in less than a week. Those from New York alone were within call, and 2,000 of them arrived soon, after he sent Loudon the above letter. Then, by stripping all the forts below, he could bring together 4,500 men, while several French deserters assured him that Montcalm had nearly 12,000. To advance to the relief of Monroe with a force so inferior, through a defile of rocks, forests, and mountains, made by nature for ambuscades, and this too with troops who had neither the steadiness of regulars nor the bush-fighting skill of Indians, was an enterprise for firmer nerve than his. He had already warned Monroe to expect no help from him. At midnight of the 4th, Captain Bartman, his aide-de-camp, wrote, "The general has ordered me to acquaint you he does not think it prudent to attempt a junction or to assist you till reinforced by the militia of the colonies, for the immediate march of which repeated expresses have been sent." The letter then declared that the French were in complete possession of the road between the two forts, that a prisoner just brought in reported their force in many and cannon to be very great, and that, unless the militia came soon, Monroe had better make what terms he could with the enemy. The chance was small that this letter would reach its destination, and in fact the bearer was killed by Lockhorn's Indians, who, in stripping the body, found the hidden paper, and carried it to the general. Montcalm kept it several days, till the English rampart was half battered down, and then, after saluting his enemy with a volley from all his cannon, he sent it with a graceful compliment to Monroe. It was Bougainville who carried it, preceded by a drummer and a flag. He was met at the foot of the Glacis, blindfolded, and led through the fort and along the edge of the lake to the entrenched camp, where Monroe was at the time. He returned many thanks, writes the emissary in his diary, for the courtesy of our nation, and protested his joy at having to do with so generous an enemy. This was his answer to the Marquis de Montcalm. Then they led me back, always with eyes blinded, and our batteries began to fire again as soon as we thought that the English grenadiers who escorted me had time to re-enter the fort. I hope General Webb's letter may induce the English to surrender the sooner. Quote, by this time the sappers had worked their way to the angle of the lake, where they were stopped by a marshy hollow, beyond which was a tract of high ground, reaching to the fort and serving as the garden of the garrison. Logs and fascines in large quantities were thrown into the hollow, and hurdles were laid over them to form a causeway for the cannon. Then the sap was continued up the acclivity beyond, a trench was opened in the garden, and a battery begun, not 250 yards from the fort. The Indians, in great number, crawled forward among the beans, maize, and cabbages, and lay there ensconced. In the night of the 7th, two men came out of the fort, apparently to reconnoiter, with a view to a sortie, when they were greeted by a general volley and a burst of yells which echoed among the mountains, followed by responsive whoops pealing through the darkness from the various camps and lurking places of the savage warriors far and near. The position of the besieged was now deplorable. More than 300 of them had been killed and wounded. Smallpox was raging in the fort, the place was a focus of infection, and the casemates were crowded with the sick. A sortie from the entrenched camp and another from the fort had been repulsed with loss. All their large cannon and mortars had been burst, or disabled by shot, only 7 small pieces were left fit for service, and the whole of Montcalm's 31 cannon and 15 mortars and howitzers would soon open fire, while the walls were already breached, and an assault was imminent. Through the night of the 8th they fired briskly from all their remaining pieces. In the morning the officers held a council, and all agreed to surrender, if honorable terms could be had. A white flag was raised, a drum was beat, and Lieutenant Colonel Young, mounted in horseback, for a shot in the foot had disabled him from walking, went, followed by a few soldiers, to the tent of Montcalm. It was agreed that the English troops should march out with the honors of war, and be escorted to Fort Edward by a detachment of French troops, that they should not serve for 18 months, and that all French prisoners captured in America, since the war began, should be given up within 3 months. The stores, munitions, and artillery were to be the prize of the victors, except one field piece, which the garrison were to retain in recognition of their brave defense. Before signing the capitulation, Montcalm called the Indian chiefs to council, and asked them to consent to the conditions, and promised to restrain their young warriors from any disorder. They approved everything and promised everything. The garrison then evacuated the fort, and marched to join their comrades in the entrenched camp, which was included in the surrender. No sooner were they gone than a crowd of Indians clambered through the embrasures in search of rum and plunder. All the sick men unable to leave their beds were instantly butchered. "I was witness of this spectacle," says the missionary Rugaud. "I saw one of these barbarians come out of the casemates with a human head in his hand, from which the blood ran in streams, and which he paraded, as if he had got the finest prize in the world." There was little left to plunder, and the Indians, joined by the more lawless of the Canadians, turned their attention to the entrenched camp, where all the English were now collected. The French guard stationed there could not or would not keep out the rabble. By the advice of Montcalm, the English stove their rum barrels, but the Indians were drunk already with homicidal rage, and the glitter of their vicious eyes told of the devil within. They roamed among the tents, intrusive, insolent, their visages besmirched with war paint, grinning like fiends, as they handled, in anticipation of the knife, the long hair of cowering women, of whom, as well as of children, there were many in the camp, all crazed with fright. Since the last war, the New England border population had regarded Indians with a mixture of detestation and horror. Their mysterious warfare of ambush and surprise, their midnight onslaughts, their butcheries, their burnings, and all their nameless atrocities, had been for years the theme of fireside story, and the dread they excited was deepened by the distrust and dejection of the time. The confusion in the camp lasted through the afternoon. "The Indians," says Bougainville, "wanted to plunder the chests of the English. The latter resisted, and there was fear that serious disorder would ensue. The Marquis de Montcalm ran thither immediately, and used every means to restore tranquility, prayers, threats, caresses, interposition of the officers and interpreters who have some influence over these savages. We shall be but too happy if we can prevent a massacre. Detestable position, of which nobody who has not been in it can have any idea, and which makes victory itself a sorrow to the victors." The Marquis spared no efforts to prevent the rapacity of the savages and, I must say it, of certain persons associated with them, from resulting in something worse than plunder. At last, at 9 o'clock in the evening, order seemed restored. The Marquis even induced the Indians to promise that, besides the escort agreed upon in the capitulation, two chiefs for each tribe should accompany the English in their way to Fort Edward. He also ordered Lockhorn and the other Canadian officers attached to the Indians to see that no violence took place. He might well have done more. In view of the disorders of the afternoon, it would not have been too much if he had ordered the whole body of regular troops, whom alone he could trust for the purpose, to hold themselves ready to move to the spot in case of outbreak, and shelter their defeated foes behind a hedge of bayonets. Bougainville was not to see what ensued, for Montcalm now sent him to Montreal, as a special messenger to carry news of the victory. He embarked at 10 o'clock. Returning daylight found him far down the lake, and as he looked on its still bosom flecked with mists, and its quiet mountains sleeping under the flush of dawn, there was nothing in the wild tranquility of the scene to suggest the tragedy which even then was beginning on the shore he had left behind. The English in their camp had passed a troubled night, agitated by strange rumors. In the morning something like a panic seized them, for they distrusted not the Indians only, but the Canadians. In their haste to be gone they got together at daybreak, before the escort of 300 regulars had arrived. They had their muskets, but no ammunition, and few or none of the provincials had bayonets. Early, as it was, the Indians were on the alert, and, indeed, Since midnight, great numbers of them had been prowling about the skirts of the camp, showing, says Colonel Fry, more than usual malice in their looks. 17 wounded men of his regiment lay in huts, unable to join the march. In the preceding afternoon, Miles Wickworth, the regimental surgeon, had passed them over to the care of a French surgeon, according to an agreement made at the time of the surrender, but, the Frenchman being absent, the other remained with them attending to their wants. The French surgeon had caused special sentinels to be posted for their protection.
These were now removed, at the moment, when they were needed most, upon which, about 5 o'clock in the morning, the Indians entered the huts, dragged out the inmates, and tomahawked and scalped them all, before the eyes of Wickworth, and in presence of Lockhorn and other Canadian officers, as well as of a French guard stationed within 40 feet of the spot, and, declares the surgeon under oath, none, either officer or soldier, protected the said wounded men. The opportune butchery relieved them of a troublesome burden. A scene of plundering now began. The escort had by this time arrived, and Monroe complained to the officers that the capitulation was broken, but got no other answer than advice to give out the baggage to the Indians in order to appease them. To this the English at length agreed, but it only increased the excitement of the mob. They demanded rum, and some of the soldiers, afraid to refuse, gave it to them from their canteens, thus adding fuel to the flame. When, after much difficulty, the column at last got out of the camp and began to move along the road that crossed the rough plain between the entrenchment and the forest, the Indians crowded upon them, impeded their march, snatched caps, coats, and weapons from men and officers, tomahawked those that resisted, and, seizing upon shrieking women and children, dragged them off or murdered them on the spot. It is said that some of the interpreters secretly fomented the disorder. Suddenly there rose the screech of the war whoop. At this signal of butchery, which was given by Abenaki Christians from the mission of the Penobscot, a mob of savages rushed upon the New Hampshire men at the rear of the column, and killed or dragged away 80 of them. A frightful tumult ensued, when Montcalm, Levi's, Orlemac, and many other French officers, who had hastened from their camp in the first news of disturbance, threw themselves among the Indians, and by promises and threats tried to allay their frenzy. Kill me, but spare the English who are under my protection, exclaimed Montcalm. He took from one of them a young officer whom the savage had seized, upon which several other Indians immediately tomahawked their prisoners, lest they too should be taken from them. One writer says that a French grenadier was killed and two wounded in attempting to restore order, but the statement is doubtful. The English seemed paralyzed, and fortunately did not attempt a resistance, which, without ammunition, as they were, would have ended in a general massacre. Their broken column straggled forward in wild disorder, amid the din of hoops and shrieks, till they reached the French advance guard, which consisted of Canadians, and here they demanded protection from the officers, who refused to give it, telling them that they must take to the woods and shift for themselves. Fry was seized by a number of Indians, who, brandishing spears and tomahawks, threatened him with death and tore off his clothing, leaving nothing but breeches, shoes, and shirt. Repelled by the officers of the guard, he made for the woods. A Connecticut soldier who was present says of him that he leaped upon an Indian who stood in his way, disarmed and killed him, and then escaped, but Fry himself does not mention the incident. Captain Burke, also of the Massachusetts regiment, was stripped, after a violent struggle, of all his clothes,
then broke loose, gained the woods, spent a night shivering in the thick grass of a marsh, and in the next day reached Fort Edward. Jonathan Carver, a provincial volunteer, declares that, when the tumult was at its height, he saw officers of the French army walking about at a little distance and talking with seeming unconcern. Three or four Indians seized him, brandished their tomahawks over his head, and tore off most of his clothes, while he vainly claimed protection from a sentinel, who called him an English dog, and violently pushed him back among his tormentors. Two of them were dragging him towards the neighboring swamp, when an English officer, stripped of everything but his scarlet breeches, ran by. One of Carver's captors sprang upon him, but was thrown to the ground, whereupon the other went to the aid of his comrade and drove his tomahawk into the back of the Englishman. As Carver turned to run, an English boy, about 12 years old, clung to him and begged for help. They ran on together for a moment, when the boy was seized, dragged from his protector, and, as Carver judged by his shrieks, was murdered. He himself escaped to the forest, and after 3 days of famine reached Fort Edward. The bonds of discipline seem for the time to have been completely broken, for, while Montcalm and his chief officers used every effort to restore order, even at the risk of their lives, many other officers, chiefly of the militia, failed atrociously to do their duty. How many English were killed it is impossible to tell with exactness. Rudolph says that he saw 40 or 50 corpses scattered about the field. Levi's says 50, which does not include the sick and wounded before murdered in the camp and fort. It is certain that 600 or 700 persons were carried off, stripped, and otherwise maltreated. Montcalm succeeded in recovering more than 400 of them in the course of the day, and many of the French officers did what they could to relieve their wants by buying back from their captors the clothing that had been torn from them. Many of the fugitives had taken refuge in the fort, whither Monroe himself had gone to demand protection for his followers, and he Rudolph presently found a crowd of half-frenzied women, crying in anguish for husbands and children. All the refugees and redeemed prisoners were afterwards conducted to the entrenched camp, where food and shelter were provided for them and a strong guard set for their protection until the 15th, when they were sent under an escort to Fort Edward. Here cannon had been fired at intervals to guide those who had fled to the woods, whence they came dropping in from day to day, half dead with famine. In the morning after the massacre the Indians decamped in a body and set out for Montreal, carrying with them their plunder and some 200 prisoners, who, it is said, could not be got out of their hands. The soldiers were set to the work of demolishing the English fort, and the task occupied several days. The barracks were torn down, and the huge pine logs of the rampart thrown into a heap. The dead bodies that filled the casemates were added to the mass, and fire was set to the whole. The mighty funeral pyre blazed all night. Then, in the 16th, the army re-embarked. The din of 10,000 combatants, the rage, the terror, the agony, were gone, and no living thing was left but the wolves that gathered from the mountains to feast upon the dead. The end. A concluding word from Robert J. Cunegel. Dear American Patriot hopes you enjoy our books. Theodore Roosevelt lived his life in a manner that made government responsive to the people. He has written how to make meaningful reform possible not only for his generation but for future generations, if we read what he has said. We only need to interest others in reading what he has said to transform our government. Reading the books in DrAmericanPatriot.com and having others do the same has the potential to develop citizens and leaders capable of transforming American politics into a system of government that will be honest and responsive to a square deal. A square deal has no special deals for the rich, the middle class, or the poor. Our government today rewards citizens for not being productive. It promotes entitlements under the guise of helping people, when in fact it only helps politicians to protect their own royal positions. Policies that foster a special privileged class was the type of government policies Theodore Roosevelt fought against and won. He was a visionary. He knew this fight would need to be fought through the ages, if we were to keep our country strong. He was an intrepid pioneer that blazed a trail through a jungle of corrupt government, so that others might follow his proven and highly successful common sense approach toward honest government. His fearless course helped make America a beacon of hope to all that seek justice. His endless devotion to America helped make America a superpower that no just nation has needed to fear as long as our citizens value his lofty, resolute square deal policy toward our fellow citizens and those of other nations. Theodore Roosevelt's greatest gift to this country is before us. It is not in the past, if we, as Americans, recognize that his message is not just a story from American history pages. His message is an example, clearly defined. It details actions that are required, if we desire to do something meaningful for our country. Join the good fight today by becoming a member on our website. David Boyd, repeating what he had read, once said, "The person we become is because of our experiences in life, the people we meet, and the books we read." It is time to have others meet Theodore Roosevelt. It is time for a Theodore Roosevelt revival. Fear God and do your own part. Dare to help make Theodore Roosevelt the standard and not the exception. America needs to adopt a wise, fearless and honest role model as the standard we revere, so that our public servants know what we expect. The first step to honest government is no harder than setting proper standards of conduct for our public servants through the use of a proper role model. Can you find one quality in Theodore Roosevelt that is not right in a public servant? If you think you can, I bet your conjecture is based upon something other than truth and honest reasoning, and this American would love an opportunity to debate any such conjecture.